This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with returning guest Robert Brenner. Robert, it's great having you back on the show.
It's great being here again.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, Robert. Nice talking to you.
Howdy.
The last time we talked, we were talking about your Times Square tour. How did your last tour go back in January?
Oh, it went great. We had a surprisingly big turnout, despite the fact that there was a cold Saturday morning in Times Square in January. We sold out the tour. For those of your audience not familiar with this, this is a tour that I'm doing every month for untapped cities of Times Square in the 1970s, called Exploring the Remnants of a Gritty Old Times Square. And this covers the grind houses, the peep shows, the strip clubs, not to mention places where movies like Midnight Cowboy and Taxi Driver were shot. And it's very popular.
Yeah, and we were talking about those films. I think those films are very iconic because they really capture the atmosphere of Times Square in that era. Midnight Cowboy came out in 1969 and Taxi Driver in 1976. You actually specific locations from those films. Which ones in particular are still there?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I just saw Midnight Cowboy again last Friday night at the Metrograph, and I was struck by how much was gone, but also by how much was still there. You see Midnight Cowboy, you can briefly see Hubert's Dime Museum and Flea Circus, Colony Records, various grindhouses, including the New Amsterdam and the Harris and the Liberty and the Hotel Claridge, where John Voight's character Joe Buck stays when he first arrives in Times Square. Some of these places have been shuttered, but we do visit the locations, and you can still see the signage for a lot of them. Not the Hotel Claridge. Sadly, the Hotel Claridge has been completely demolished, but these other sites we're still able to visit. Same thing with Taxi Driver. We visit the Lyric Theater, where Travis Bickle, Robert De Niro, takes his ill-fated date to. You may recall in the movie he takes Cybill Shepherd to a porno film. Desire is Within Young Girls, and Cybill is not impressed. And the date does not go well. The Lyric is still there, although it no longer shows porno films.
Yeah, that's interesting because those places have been completely renovated, but have they preserved a significant degree of the original neon marquees of those places?
Some have, some haven't. Some they've done a beautiful restoration job, like the New Amsterdam Theater is gorgeous. My only gripe is that instead of showing kung fu flicks like it used to do when I was hanging out in Times Square in the 1970s, now it's showing Walt Disney musicals. But Walt Disney paid for the restoration, so I guess they get to decide what they want to show. Others like, the Empire Theater, they preserved the facade, but they moved the whole theater down the street. They literally lifted it up, moved it down the block, and then they gutted the interior. So the exterior is still there. It's still gorgeous, but the interior, sadly, is long gone.
I know in that film, Midnight Cowboy, the opening part, or not the original opening, but when he first gets to New York, the original scene is pretty spectacular, where it just sees they show all basically like all the neon, the different movable signage, and not just like 42nd Street. A lot of that was just the main part of Broadway.
Right, right. I mean, that was still, you know, that was the sort of the end of the, you know, the golden era of neon. As if you've been to Times Square now, you know, it's filled with these giant video display screens. Nothing against giant video displays, but I think it lacks the charm of neon. You know, I like that gritty old film noir aesthetic.
Peliter, you were recently in Times Square. What were some of your impressions?
I was, you know, the first time I was in New York City, it was 19. And I'm a little bit older now, but a few years later, I've now came back to it. I've been seeing it frequently, and it feels kind of small now, especially when you're Times Square. It is very packed with a lot of people walking around, and it is kind of stressful when you drive from, you know, here and there. I love seeing that that New York Police Department right in Times Square. I think that's funny. How it's like all these people are moving at once and everyone's touching this little that the police are right there and they could just walk out, you know, and, you know, get like a like in walking distance. Right. It's also the same place that there's a New Year's Eve. Everyone's trapped in Times Square and they can't move out. And so there's some reminiscence of, you know, being in Philadelphia. I find that Philadelphia is almost like a suburban version of New York City. Right? But I feel like Philadelphia has bigger space, and you can walk, and you have some space, you know, you have distance. But in New York, it's like there's at least people here and there, and it's crowded, and it feels big at first, but if you get the right, comfort zone, you kind of measure, or at least move around New York that way.
Well, I would say that Times Square has always been crowded. But the nature of the crowd has changed. When I grew up, it was primarily locals, not tourists. Now it's just the opposite. It's primarily tourists. And one of the reasons, frankly, that it feels so crowded now is that tourists don't know how to walk like New Yorkers do. I've always wanted to teach a class on how to walk like a New Yorker, which means, you know, walk single file, keep right. Don't stop in the middle of an intersection to take a selfie. Absolutely no mulling whatsoever. It's also funny you mentioned that little police station. Now that was originally the Army recruiting station. They built a new one at the beginning of the millennium, but that used to be the Army recruiting station. And the police station, now they're talking about sadly tearing that down, which I hate the idea. It has some historic murals on either side of it, with a map of the city up until like the 1950s, which is the last time it was updated. So that's a little piece of Times Square that I'm including on my walking tour. And as always with all these things I do on my tour, It's sort of a race to see these things before somebody decides to tear them down.
Do you include the New York Times Square subway station on your tour, and how massive is that?
I don't do the subway station, although it is tempting. But navigating just a Times Square above ground is challenging enough. I'm not sure even I would be willing to take a tour group down into the subway station. Although it's an interesting idea. There's some nice murals down there, and there's a nice record store down there. There's a remnant of when Times Square was a music mecca, where people would come up to Times Square to shop for vinyl records, Colony Records, which I mentioned previously. That was the big record store in Times Square, but it was by no means the only record store in Times Square.
You mentioned in your tour description you discover the dirtiest hotel in America. Is that the Claris from A Midnight Cowboy?
No. The Hotel Claridge was a palace compared to the Hotel Carter. The Carter was the dirtiest hotel in America. It is currently closed for renovations. We'll see whether or not it ever reopens. But I would think twice about ever staying in there. There have been at least 9 recorded deaths in the Hotel Carter, including multiple homicides and suicides. And those are just the ones that they reported to the police. I suspect there have been many more deaths at the Carter. I always tell people if they ever want to shoot a sequel to The Shining, this would be the perfect hotel for it. You certainly would never get me to stay in there overnight.
Yeah, there was this place I know in downtown L.A. I think it was called, I forget what it's called off the top of my head. I think it was something like the Million Dollar Hotel. Oh, it was a Hotel Cecil off of Main Street in downtown L.A. And it used to have this really horrible reputation. I think Richard Ramirez killed a bunch of people there. But now they're renovating it into this upscale hotel. But in downtown L.A., at least they've been gentrifying things, but they've been preserving a lot of the original signage.
Yeah, I don't know what the plans are for the Carter. You know, on TripAdvisor, it won dirtiest hotel like 5 years running before they shut it down. And I'm not sure how they're possibly going to get all the bed bugs out of that place.
In downtown L.A., they just restored this blade sign of this old building they renovated.
Yes, it would be nice. There, you know, more respect for history in Times Square, and that they would preserve more of the original signage. Unfortunately, a lot of it has been torn down.
Yeah, I mean that's interesting. LA's done a better job with downtown, and it could be because LA is recently rediscovering their downtown when New York has sort of had Times Square for a long time and they've been kind of dismissive of it as a tourist area, where downtown LA is being revitalized, but it's more catering more to locals. Well, locals and tourists, but there's a strong interest in it.
I mean, there's been some restoration. One place I show people on the tour is the old Paramount Theater. Now, this was a movie theater / music venue, and everyone from Bing Crosby to Frank Sinatra to Elvis Presley to even the Beatles performed there. But by the time I started going to Times Square in the 70s, they had been gutted and turned into office space for the New York Times. In 2000, the World Wrestling Federation, now World Wrestling Entertainment, opened up a rock and wrestling club on that spot, and they restored the original marquee. They looked at old photographs and architectural drawings and did a very nice job restoring the marquee for that building. So at least looks like what it did back in the day.
I'm looking at a picture of the Hotel Carter. So there's this like gold marquee with light bulbs. Across the street, I see this pink neon blade sign for parking. Is that parking sign still there?
I'm gonna try and see if I can get the same image. I am skeptical. That's because we've lost so much of the I'm gonna have to check that. I really don't recall whether that parking sign is still there. But I'm looking at the photo now. It makes the Hotel Carter look like really glamorous and a fabulous place to stay. God forbid, people run screaming from the Hotel Carter these days. Another hotel we cover. We'll cover a couple of hotels on the tour. One of them we do was the Knickerbocker, which is a fabulous old hotel that dates back to 1904 to the very beginning of what we consider Times Square, and up until the 20s, this was a very very luxurious chic. Spot, Ernest Hemingway used to hang out in the bar drinking, that sort of thing. But it fell on hard times. It never became as seedy as a Hotel Carter. but I certainly struggled in the 70s to keep out the drugs and prostitution. But right now they've restored that into this very swanky luxury hotel, and I suspect neither you nor I could afford to stay there now. Might be able to buy a cocktail in the bar. Never know.
Do you remember the Milford Hotel in near Times Square?
I know the name. I don't have any specific details about the Milford. The other hotel that we do cover on the tour is the Elk Hotel, and this is a legendary hot sheet hotel that was just shuttered recently. It has a reputation for being the last hot sheet hotel in Times Square. By hot sheet, I mean this is one of these hotels where the rooms rented by the hour. And it was very popular with hookers, johns, junkies, winos, anyone who needed to stay in Times Square and didn't have a lot of money. But it has its fans. It even has a Facebook page. There's the Elk Hotel Appreciation Society Facebook page. I urge your listeners to go out and sign up for this page. Get the inside dope on the Elk.
There was this restaurant called Bon 45, and that looked pretty cool, but you told me that recently closed.
Okay, yeah, that's a sad story. I actually used to include Bonds on the tour when I first started because the sign was still there. Bonds was a men's clothing store when I was growing up. Then for a while in the 80s, it was a punk rock nightclub, The Clash. Played a memorable spring of concerts there. More recently, yes, it was Bon 45. It was a not particularly distinguished Italian restaurant, but at least they still had the big Bon sign there, which is a New York, which was a Times Square landmark. But now they completely torn down that corner, and unfortunately, I cannot include that on the tour anymore. There's just nothing to show. There's nothing to show people there. Again, as I said, sometimes it's a race against time to show people things before the wrecking ball arrives.
Are there other places in New York City that have kind of that seedy old stuff? What about some of the areas that are lower income areas like East Harlem or the Bronx?
It's funny you should mention East Harlem. I was just in Spanish Harlem this afternoon, actually doing research for another walking tour. I was up on 116th Street, East 116th Street, and that's really unchanged right now, which is one of the reasons I like it. If you want to get a feel of old New York, go up to East 116th Street, or better yet, sign up for one of my walking tours. But the problem that we see or that we envision encroaching is the Second Avenue subway. They finally built the part of the Second Avenue subway. It now goes up as far as 96th Street. It's still 20 blocks away from 116th Street, but people are already starting to feel the forces of gentrification slowly creep north. So visit it now while you can still see it in all its glory, and also try the fabulous food. It's a great eating neighborhood. It's a great place to get both Spanish and Italian delicacies. There's a place called Cucci Fritos, which specializes in fried pork products. I'm a big fan of anything fried or anything with pork in it, and they have fried pork. So two of my loves, and then they have Patsy's, which is like one of the oldest. Pizzerias in New York City, and they still have a coal-burning oven. There's only about four of those left in New York City, and I believe they're the only coal-burning oven that serves pizza by the slice, which is very usual. Most places, Leonardo's, you have to go buy a whole pie. This is a great place to get a great single slice.
Is that on Times Square, actually? Patsy's?
No, we're up. You're thinking of a different Patsy. We're up in East Harlem, right?
I thought I saw.
We're skipping around. We're up in East Harlem right now, and also Raoul's is in East Harlem, and that's like one of the most exclusive restaurants in New York City, you basically have to inherit a table there if you want to dine there. So, Spanish Harlem is a great place to see the real city the way it was back in the day. And Times Square, although it's been Disneyfied, I could still find bits and pieces of the real Times Square. Show World is still there, thank God. The Playpen is still there. A lot of the old grindhouses have been gussied up, but at least they've been saved. The Hotel Carter has been shuttered, and the Elk's been shuttered, but they haven't been torn down yet. So there's still
for the Carter been taken down, or that's still there?
No, the sign is still up. That's thank God the sign is still up, and it still looks nice from a distance. Although once you get close and you see the lobby, it looks very ominous. As I said, I would not set foot in that building. I certainly wouldn't stay there overnight.
On your tour, you talk about some of the different figures that made Times Square. You talk about the king of peeps, Marty
right.
Hodes.
My personal hero, Marty Hodes. He's the king of the peeps. He's the guy who brought peep shows to Times Square in the 1960s. He became an overnight millionaire until he was finally busted by the feds in the 1970s for income tax invasion. He's a great kind of rise and fall story, and I always thought his life would make a great movie.
And you also talk about the woman who built the gay and S&M porn empire.
Right. Yes. Yeah, Kelly Wilson. She's another interesting figure. She was a few women who were working behind the camera in porn, and actually built a business running all the gay porn theaters like the Eros and the Venus and the Adonis and Gay T for Less. But she also had a sideline. Avon Productions. Avon Productions specialized in making "quote unquote" roughies. These were porno films with an S&M theme. Yes, long before Fifty Shades of Grey, people were into S&M. Sadly, most of her theaters are gone, but you can still find Avon Productions on if you look around on the web. I think you can even purchase them through Amazon if you kids want to see what your parents got off on back in the 70s.
Huh.
Some pretty kinky stuff.
Are you familiar with the book by Josh Alan Friedman on Times Square? I actually discovered him via his book is published by Feral House, and we recently had Adam Parfrey on. Do you know Joshua Alan Friedman?
Yeah. Yes, I've read his book and admire it very much. That's a very useful book. It captures a lot of the characters in and around Times Square. I think one of the interesting things about that book is it also points out that what was going on in Times Square wasn't just isolated to Times Square. He also spends a good amount of time discussing what was going on the Upper West Side. At Plato's Retreat, which was a notorious swingers club in the basement of the Ansonia Hotel. People forget that in the 1970s, the Upper West Side was almost as sleazy as Times Square.
Really, I would never think of that. I would say most people, their perception is that the Upper East Side and the Upper West Side are the two most exclusive parts of New York.
Now, Upper East Side was always pretty tony, but the Upper West Side was pretty sleazy. Even when I moved to the Upper West Side in the early 1980s, I would go to Verde Park, which AKA Needle Park, which was featured in Panic in Needle Park, and you would still see junkies nodding out in the park. And as I said. Plato's Retreat was the big swingers club on the Upper West Side. It wasn't really until the 90s that the Upper West Side really became gentrified and cleaned up, and you don't see many remnants of its seedy past.
There was an article published on Untapped City cities, and there's also one on Gizmodo about these proposals to redevelop Times Square in the 1980s. And I was looking over some of them, and I mean, the plan would have been to completely destroy Times Square, but at the same time, I mean, I think a lot of them are still a lot more innovative than what you have today.
Yeah, you know, there were many plans to redevelop Times Square. The most ambitious one, although also probably the most destructive one, would be to cover all of Times Square with this giant glass bubble, essentially. And turn it into an indoor theme park. I don't know if I'm happy or sad that that never came about. But it certainly would have been different from what they have today.
Out of those different proposals, I think the most have you seen the one by Lee Dunnett? I think that one's the most interesting.
What was that one?
Well, there's one. The one by Lee Dunnett is like this kind of a spaceship, and it's all this like this big giant blue neon tube. And there's another one by Gilbert Gorski that it's more kind of an Art Deco, and it kind of it does kind of have that feeling from the film Metropolis. I mean, it's still. I mean, these proposals. I mean, would as destructive as you could say they were, I mean, I still would prefer a lot of them to what you have today.
Yeah, I agree. There were a lot of fanciful proposals about what to do about Times Square, but most of them were DOA. They really never got off the drawing board. Periodically, they would have these competitions where they would tell, you know, architecture firms to go nuts and come up with your most wildest proposal. And these were, you know, these are of historical interest, but none of these ever really got traction. Although I admit what they came up with, which is, you know, these four rather generic office towers dominating the landscape is probably the worst of all the proposals. And of course, that's the one they went with.
It's interesting because different realities on Times Square because. When I was at Times Square, you know, I've seen, like, those big, like, Lego Batman movie looking above you down. You're, like, belittled by this giant cartoon character, like the M&M's people. As if the future, you know, if anything's turned more cyberpunk or holograms become real, it's almost like the sky is going to be animated and everything below us is scuttled of people, right? There's this kind of Japan or at least Tokyo emulation they're trying to do at New York or at least Times Square. I don't see it. I think it's a very Americanized. I don't see the Japanese flair at all, but still the technology is it's advancing, and when I see these different designs, it's very much of like Fritz Lang's Metropolis or some kind of Art Deco or Deco Punk style of living.
Yeah. I wish it would look like Metropolis. You know, at least that would have some style. One of the points I want to make is that the whole scale of Times Square has changed. Times Square used to be filled with buildings that were two or three stories tall. So it was just, you know, it was just a much more human scale of architecture. Starting in 1982, though, you started seeing some gigantic hotels being built that kind of dwarf the surrounding landscape. And, you know, my problem with, you know, these big, gigantic buildings, there's something inhuman or even fascistic about it.
Do you like the whole kind of 80s retro-futuristic aesthetic?
Not so much. Look, I like Beaux-Arts. I like Art Deco, but I don't like retro anything. I don't like trying to recreate something, because invariably it ends up feeling false, you know, and artificial.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, the buildings I've seen from the 1980s, they suffer from a paucity of imagination. Most of them just seem to be, you know, sort of references to other buildings.
Wasn't the films like Blade Runner and Spot, they definitely, you see the film noir influence.
Well, yeah, well, the Blade Runner is interesting because, you know, Ridley Scott manages to merge both science fiction and film noir quite effectively. If that's what they were going for in Times Square, they have missed the mark. They have not achieved it.
I think you did write about David Lynch's Blue Velvet.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a big Lynch fan, and I came to do movie reviews for the Huffington Post. I'm not, you know, but Lynch is really much more an LA sort of filmmaker. I think of like movie like Mulholland Drive. I don't think that could be made in Times Square.
From what I've like heard, his Eraserhead was based around Philadelphia, actually, and that always made me thought about Eraserhead and whether, because I do see some of that Eraserhead influence within Philadelphia, actually.
Well, the only thing related to Times Square as Eraserhead is, of course, that was very popular in the grindhouses.
Yeah,
you know, any kind of weird, you know, sci-fi, horror, fantasy, you could see that somewhere on the deuce. So certainly those early David Lynch films would pop up on 42nd Street. Later on, when it got more artsy, not so much.
The film kind of came to my attention because I was working on a painting and someone said, like, your color palette reminded me exactly like that film Blue Velvet.
Well, you know, it's a film with, among other things, you know, these sort of very vivid colors, but it also has a very small town feel to it, which is very different, I think, than from Times Square. Again, it just does not feel like a film, not like the way, you know, Midnight Cowboy is or Taxi Driver is. I love it; it's a classic, but it's a very different aesthetic.
What was the most recent film that best captures Times Square since those films are made, like talking about the 80s and 90s?
The best film that captures Times Square? A recent vintage? That's very hard. I mean, I was just seeing that Basket Case, which was a horror film shot in 1982 with just added to the Museum of Modern Art's collection. And that certainly captures some of that scrungy Times Square milieu. But as I said, that was shot in 1982. As a matter of fact, I can't see anyone shooting a movie in Times Square now because Times Square itself has become totally artificial. It's like a movie set now. So, you know, you would not go there looking for authenticity.
Oh, Basket Case, that was a slasher film. But I see that. That shows like all the peep shows.
Yes, yes. And as I said, it, the MoMA, just the Museum of Modern Art, just added it to his collection. And a bit of cinema verite that was shot in and around Times Square, and then that showed in the grindhouses in Times Square for years afterwards. So people would watch Eraserhead and say, oh, I know that place. Oh, that was shot right outside.
What are some of the other tours? You said you have four different tours going on. What are the other ones besides the Times Square tour?
Yeah, yes. Let me plug my other tours. What's your rule on obscenity? Can I use obscenity on this interview?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I have the Fuck Trump Midtown Cheap Ethnic Eats walking tour, which I'm doing every Saturday for local expeditions. And that came out about local expeditions approached me about doing a food walking tour. And I said, okay, let me think about that. And then I thought, you know, I would do some sort of cheap ethnic eats walking tour in Midtown. And this is right around the time. This is right around the time of the inauguration when I was developing this. And I was, as I was working on the itinerary for the tour, I was thinking, gee, this is everything Donald Trump would hate. It's cheap, it's inexpensive, it's foreign cuisine, it's foreigners, there's Muslims, there's Chinese, there's Mexicans. So I just named it the Fuck Trump Midtown Ethnic Eats Walking Tour. We'll see whether or not I'll keep that title, but it certainly evoked the feeling of the tour. I'm also doing. I continue to do for the Municipal Arts Society of New York their 34th Street Empire to Penn Walking Tour. I do that about once a month for them, and then of course I have my own small custom food, history, architecture walking tours. Very inexpensive. That can be scheduled at your convenience. If you want to go up to Spanish Harlem, for example, and have me talk about the history of Spanish Harlem, and also where to get a good slice of pizza, I'm your man.
Oh, you're saying you do custom made tours? If someone wants to spend a lot of money, they can commission any tour.
I wouldn't say a lot of money. I think I'm very reasonable. But I will construct custom tours with people based upon, you know, neighborhoods they want to explore and things they want to eat, frankly.
You could do like the 99-cent pizza tour.
Well, yeah, you know, see, this is a very interesting question. I'm not particularly interested in 99% pizza. So if somebody told me that, I would say, no, I'm probably not the man for you. On the other hand, if you wanted to go on search for the best slices of pizza in New York City, I would be totally down with that. That's a fabulous theme for a custom tour. I was also working on, you know, the best pastrami sandwich in New York City tour. This is a pastrami sandwich is this iconic New York City sandwich, and we are blessed with many fine pastrami venues. So looking for the best pastrami sandwich, I think, would be a great theme for a custom tour.
I know Untapped Cities, they also do tours of a Grand Central Station and the subway system. Have you been on those tours?
No, I have to sign up for that. You know, I've been frankly so busy with my own tours, I don't have that much time to do their tours, which is a pity, isn't a shame, because Untapped Cities has some great tours. And I strongly recommend, if you're not taking one of my tours, take one of the other tours from Untapped Cities. Or from the Municipal Arts Society, or from local expeditions. They're all fine organizations, and I urge your listeners to get out there and support them all. Although I also urge them to get out there and support me and contact Pickfeet Walking Tours.
And you said the one you do, it's a walking tour, so it's the Empire State Building to Penn Station.
This tour I do for the Municipal Arts Society of New York is sponsored by the 34th Street Partnership, which is a business improvement district. But the rules are very flexible. Basically, I can go anywhere in the business district and focus on whatever I want. Although, yes, the tour always includes the Empire State Building and Penn Station. But I also go to Koreatown. Because I just like Koreatown. I like talking about Korean food, and better yet, eating Korean food. And I also spend a lot of time talking about when the area was known as the Tenderloin or Satan Circus. Before Times Square was the red light district of New York City, the area around Herald Square was the red light district. And I think that's sort of fascinating that, you know, that the Vice District move steadily north with the development of the city.
Hillier, what is that Japanese bookstore you like going to in New York?
It was Kina Kuniya. That's a bookstore right next to, I think, the big HBO building and where buses often get off at. It's really close in walking distance of Times Square, and that is a very enjoyable bookstore. I'm usually around that area when I get into Manhattan with friends and such. But it's a very enjoyable place, and I'm very familiar with it now. And other places that I like. Like last time I was there, I was actually at, I think it was in Queens. I went to that that LaBeouf thing, the He Will Not Divide Us, that whole anti-Trump thing where there's like a camera and basically people can say stuff to this camera and, you know, say how much. But it turns out the people who are pro-Trump went to this camera and said things. And I was actually was over there a bit at that gallery.
Did you see anything, Pilliter, or no?
I didn't cam myself. I was a little too, because I was learning about it in a single day. We didn't go just to go see that, and which I think was amazing. And I kind of learned about that.
Yeah, there's all sorts of pro and anti-Trump protests going on in the city on an almost daily basis. Frankly, I avoid a Trump Tower as much as possible, just because the traffic has become terrible. But there's stuff going on all the time. You know, I participated in some of the protests, and I suspect I'll be participating in more protests before this administration is done.
Oh, I forgot. I also really like the New York Times building. I seem to really like those. When you get out of that tunnel underground, I think, and it's like $15 to get through. If you take a certain distance from, I think, left or right, you get to see the New York Times building. I don't know if it's in Manhattan.
Is that the new one?
It always let me. I think it's New York Times building. It's
Well, the New York Times has had like three different locations in Times Square, and we actually visit all three of them on my Times Square walking tour. Certainly, the original Times Square Tower is still there. That was built in 1904, although you wouldn't recognize it. And then across the street, across 7th Avenue, there's the Paramount building.
It's the one with the kitchen, right? The Schnipper's Kitchen, I think it is.
And that's the newest. That's the latest one that was built in around 2000. That's the latest and greatest of the three New York Times buildings in Times Square. I think architecturally the least interesting of the three, but definitely has had an impact on Times Square. When they built that, they tore down the notorious Terminal Bar, which was the most notorious dive bar in Times Square, that had the reputation of being the most dangerous bar in Times Square. And, you know, even I would not go in there. It was too scary. Too many people went in there and never came out again. There's an interesting book published last year about the Terminal Bar. It turns out one of the bartenders was a amateur photographer, and he took portraits of a lot of the denizens of the Terminal Bar. And his son published the photographs. So you finally get to see what it was like inside the Terminal Bar. I will add that getting back to our discussion of
there was footage of the Terminal Bar in the scene Taxi Driver.
Right. That's what I'm about to touch upon. There's a scene in Taxi Driver that's shot in front of the Terminal Bar. Robert De Niro and Peter Doyle, you know, Travis Bickle and Wizard, you know, two cabbies, are hanging out in front of the Terminal Bar, talking, and Travis Bickle was trying to tell Wizard, "I've got some bad ideas in my head," and you know, Wizard is saying, "Yeah, gee, we all get depressed every now and then," not grasping that Robert De Niro's character is about to go off on a killing spree.
Yeah, I think a film like that would be too controversial to make today, with all the like different the kind of like killing spree theme.
Well, I don't know. Films, if anything, have gotten more violent. You know, when they made Taxi Driver, the violence was very controversial. But you see more killing in, you know, like John Wick 2 than in Taxi Driver. I just saw Logan the week before, which is a great film. But the level of violence is astronomical compared to Taxi Driver. Two very different sorts of films, but violence-wise, you can't compare them.
Are you a fan of Paul Schrader's Mishima, Life in Four Chapters?
Excuse me? I'm not familiar with that. What is that?
Okay, I guess if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, I guess I'm not, because I don't know what you're referring to.
Mishima, Life in Four Chapters, it's another Paul Schrader film that came out in 85.
Mishima, the Japanese guy?
Yeah.
Who tried to overthrow the Japanese government and then committed to harikari when his military coup collapsed.
That's the one.
I like the movie. I don't remember too much about it. I liked Mishima as a writer, but unfortunately he went a little nuts towards the end. Some people think he was suffering from roid rage. You know, he was a bodybuilder among others.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently he was taking a lot of steroids towards the end. So maybe that pushed him over the edge.
Are you familiar with like the Brooklyn area, or is it certain areas of New York? Or
I'm mostly Manhattan based, although I'm branching out to Brooklyn, to Fort Greene, to downtown Brooklyn, to Burham Hill, to Atlantic Avenue. So I'm trying to increase my Brooklyn chops.
Because I used to go to Brooklyn, I used to go to this little niche place. It's kind of in an Asian section. It's called the Next Level Arcade, and it's one of the only competitive arcade scenes in that Asian town area, where they'll go play Street Fighter, King of Fighters, and everyone brings their joysticks and play Street Fighter World. It's pretty funny.
Oh, cool. I'd love to see that. You don't see as many arcades in Manhattan's Chinatown anymore. When I was growing up, if you wanted to go to arcades, you either went to Times Square or you went to Chinatown. Those were the two big arcade locations. But I'm not surprised to hear that it's moved out to Brooklyn.
You were talking about the New York Times headquarter. What do you think about the New Yorker headquarter?
New Yorker headquarter? Well, they moved out of Times Square, didn't they? You're talking about New Yorker magazine?
Yeah, is that still there?
No. They packed up and moved out of Times Square, which I think is also, you know, a pity and a shame. How can you be?
Well, maybe that picture is it the New Yorker Hotel? That could be.
The New Yorker Hotel is the New Yorker Hotel. That's near Penn Station, not Times Square, and that's a fascinating. Hotel. When that was built at the beginning of the 20th century, around the time when Penn Station was built, the original Penn Station, you know, it was opened in 1910. I think the New Yorker opened in like 1924. Don't quote me on it, but I think that's pretty close. That was popular with the celebrities at the time, you know, people like Cary Grant and Mae West and the Marx Brothers all stayed there. And it was so popular with celebrities, they actually built a secret underground tunnel from the New Yorker to Penn Station, so these celebrities could get in and out without being mobbed by their fans. There's some talk about reopening this tunnel to reduce pedestrian congestion. I talk a lot about this hotel on the 34th Street tour for the Municipal Art Society. In the 70s, this hotel was bought by the Reverend Sun Ya-moon of the Unification Church, the Moonies, and they actually still own it, although they license it now to a reputable hotel management company to manage it for them.
Isn't that a Korean cult of like Christians or something? The Moonies,
right? That was a ostensibly Christian Korean. Cult, like most cults, it was a scam. It was about making money for the Reverend Sun Ya-moon and bilking his followers.
I see some Moonies around here too, and there it's kind of still popular. I don't know. I think it's something within the Korean, but that's interesting. In New York, they have.
Yeah,
that.
I haven't seen any Moonies for a while, so I'm interested to know that they're still out there.
For the Huffington Post, you've written on the topic of artificial intelligence and economic automation. How much of an issue do you see that in the future, and how will it play in our economy?
Well, you know, there's two ways. Always, if people are talking about artificial intelligence and robotics, there's two ways that can always play out. One is, you know, the idea where it gives, like, everyone more free time to enjoy themselves, in which case they have plenty of time to go on walking tours and explore the history of the city. But that's the optimistic view. The pessimistic view is that it triggers mass unemployment as people's jobs are replaced by robots and AIs, and nobody has money to do anything, let alone spend it on walking tours. My fear is the day when they can get a robot that's smart enough to give a walking tour, in which case they won't need me.
Yeah, but the key issue, I guess, is how will the profits be utilized? Will it go to a basic income, or will it just be go to the top 1%?
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath about this basic income idea, at least not in the United States. You know, the United States has this puritanical streak where, you know, if you don't personally make every single penny yourself, you're a bad person. So I think the basic guaranteed income is just sort of antithetical to the American psyche. But, you know, I'd love to be proven wrong. I'd love to just have a basic income and focus on giving walking tours.
This kind of ties in a little bit with what we were talking about earlier. But what do you think about the rise in sex robots and virtual sex in the future?
Well, that's kind of an interesting development, too. I mean, that's also right around the corner. We've joked about this for a long time. I don't think we're too far away from seeing, like, you know, porno films featuring, you know, sex bots and humans interacting with robots. We'll see what happens. And people start taking robots as sex partners. Will people marry the robots in the future? I just don't know. I don't know how society's going to react to that.
Robert, I think in my book, I had a short story actually about vaporwave and robot sex. Actually, it's funny you mentioned that.
Was that the Natalie Portman thing?
No, it was a short story. It's like, I think it's on chapter 5 of my book. I wrote about, I think you talked about too, about android sex and science fiction vaporwave universe, kind of like Mishima's Life in 4 Chapters, and just I made a creative writing story about that. And for my experience on the whole robot thing, I'm like, well, certainly you don't have robots yet, but it's a possibility in a science fiction world. We could just get on demand hookers, and basically porn becomes real through robots. I don't know.
Yeah, as I said, I think that's definitely going to happen. I think what's going to be more interesting is what happens when people want to marry their robot companion. I'm not sure the world is ready for that yet.
Well, who knows? I mean, you see these like reports from Japan. I think there was a guy who married like an anime character. I don't know if it was real or a parody.
Well, that's Japan. You know, Japan is always, you know, starting the cutting edge on unusual relationships. Let's say I'll try not to make any value judgments. Will that catch on to the States? I don't know. I mean, we just passed gay marriage, but now there's this huge backlash from conservatives against gay marriage. So we'll see what happens.
Didn't you review some Japanese movies for Huffington Post or a Japanese film festival?
Yeah, you know, I'm a member of Japan Society. I see a lot of films there, and I've reviewed you know, samurai films for them, Yakuza films for them, Japanese musicals. I'm actually very excited. At the end of this month, they're going to be doing a festival of Japanese science fiction called Beyond Godzilla, in which they'll be going into other less well-known, at least in the United States, Japanese science fiction and horror movies. So I'm looking forward to seeing that and writing about it.
There's this manga from 1988, Akira, and it definitely has that kind of old-time square, like a cyberpunk, like Blade Runner feel to it.
Yeah, I've seen Akira a long time ago. I saw Ghost in the Shell a long time ago. As you probably know, there's a live-action version of Ghost in the Shell, starring Scarlett Johansson, opening later this summer, which I'm looking for, which I'm looking forward to seeing.
I just remembered something. I'll probably be back in New York sooner, but I'll definitely be in New York City this September when Depeche Mode comes, either on September 11th or the 9th, because Depeche Mode did a song, or no, there was a cover of Enjoy the Silence in the Ghost in the Shell film, and I just thought that was funny, actually.
Well, look me up in the, when you get to the city, I'll show you around.
Well, I don't know if, Depeche Mode might do something New York style, especially if a suspicious date of September the 11th. I mean, if they're going to talk about Enjoy the Silence and make it very patriotic about the Twin Towers, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. You know Depeche Mode better than I do.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Robert, do you want to plug your next tour this month?
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to plug away relentlessly. So Sunday, March 19th, for Untapped Cities, the next gritty old Times Square walking tour. There are still a few tickets left. Get them now. Every Saturday, for local expeditions, I'm doing this Midtown Cheap Eat, Ethnic Eats, Fuck Trump walking tour. If you want to find some unusual places to eat in Midtown and support a worthy cause, that's a good tour. 34th Street, Empire to Penn, I'm doing that once a month for Municipal Art Society, but I haven't scheduled my next one yet, but it's coming. Drop me a line, I'll tell you when it is. And Pick Feet Walking Tours, really, that's pretty much at your convenience and any mutually agreed upon time that I have the most flexibility. But definitely Sunday, March 19th, gritty old Times Square walking tour. Be there or be square. Untapped Cities.
Robert Brenner, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you, like always.